Hey guys, I would just like to thank you for being so patient during COVID. I went down the COVID rabbit hole, as I'm sure many of you did. But luckily during that time, we still had some new patrons show up. So thank you to Gabrielle T. And we also had one new elder, which was Justin from the Obscura True Crime podcast. So I have to get together with him and do one of the extra bonuses for that. But again, thank you guys so much for understanding and still being here when I came back. And I hope you all are doing well. Thank you to all the patrons and the supporters. Here's the episode.
Welcome back, Collective. Kelly is back. We're going to talk about some things and probably, you know, it'll be depressing, the standard.
It's okay. Keep it consistent, right? I mean, that's the way to do it.
Consistently depressing. You're welcome. So today, we're going to talk about war. Which war? So many wars. The Korean War.
So many to choose from.
Sadly, so many to choose from. And this is going to be like an intro to the Korean War because obviously it's a very in-depth topic. There's a bunch of history podcasts that I'm sure have done it. Check them out if you want to go more in-depth. But as you know, I do plan to cover other things that happened during the Korean War. So I figured let's do an overview.
Sure.
Especially because Korea politically is so fascinating.
I mean, even still today, like it's amazing, like how much is going on and how much, especially in America, we still hear about stuff going on in Korea.
Oh, yeah. Because, I mean, Kim Jong-un is definitely alive and definitely doesn't have gout. He definitely doesn't have gout in a country that's starving. So let's talk about Korea before the war. It was actually controlled by Imperial Japan and they took over from the Chinese because, yeah, they did that shit. As a lot of people who only study European history don't think about. There are many different empires, many different Asian countries, expanded, contracted, all of that. So during the first Sino-Japanese War, which was 1894 to 95, there was a short Korean Empire, and then we have Japan defeating Russia in the Russo-Japanese War of 1904 and 1905. That's when Japan was like, hey, Korea, you're going to be a protectorate. That means, hey, you want to be a little colony? And then we'll slowly incorporate you. If you see protectorate, you go, okay, so colony. Got it.
Right. Let's just call it what it is.
Yeah. They actually annexed it with the Japan-Korea Annexation Treaty in 1910. So with that, we see many of the Korean nationalists fleeing the country. And at that point, it's still one peninsula. It's not divided. They go on to found the Provisional Government of the Republic of Korea in 1919 in nationalist China. Because also at this point, China's starting to go through a civil war. There's a lot of things happening there and not going to go deeply into it.
Okay.
So just because it's a lot. I took an entire class on modern China. It's a lot. So they didn't get international recognition because they wanted to like kind of kickstart this so they could retake their country back from Japan. And they really had a pretty contentious relationship with the U.S. U.S.-based founding president. So there's a couple nationalist groups going on. We have Syngman Rhee, who will come up again. And so the groups are fighting within each other. So it's hard to kickstart a revolution if everybody cannot agree on certain things. On top of that, from 1919 to 1925 and continuing later, Korean communists inside the country led an internal and external warfare against the Japanese. So you see them trying to start a revolution.
Okay.
While in China, the National Revolutionary Army and the Communist People's Liberation Army helped to organize the Korean refugees against the Japanese military. So they're really trying to kick Imperial Japan out. And because the Japanese at this point are also occupying parts of China because it's a peninsula, you know, you can go up and be like, hey, cool. The nationalist-backed Koreans led by Yi Pom-sok fought in the Burma campaign, and the communists were led by Kim Il-sung, and they fought the Japanese in Korea and Manchuria. So you see the Koreans working with the Chinese throughout this to really kick Japan off the continent. However, at the Cairo Conference after World War II in November 1943, China, the United Kingdom, and the U.S. all decided in due course, quote, or decide that, quote, in due course, Korea shall become free and independent, end quote. This is where we get the division, shall we say. So if studiers of World War II know the Tehran Conference and then the Yalta Conference, they're kind of where the end of the war, basically everything's starting to get hashed out. The Soviet Union at these conferences, aka Stalin, said, okay, we're going to come into the Pacific War within 3 months of victory in Europe, which makes sense because Stalin's solution to a lot of problems with fighting the Nazis was to just throw people at it, which luckily for the Soviet Union, they had the enough people, but it made them fighting Japan harder for them. So they declared war on Japan on August 9th, 1945, 3 days after the bombing of Hiroshima. So
what a tough hit. I mean, we just finished up Hiroshima and now let's go to war.
Right? They're like, oh, we're coming in, guys. I mean, there's debates on whether or not the second bombing stopped the war or they were actually going to surrender after the first. So, I mean, it's a good show that they were going to go in there, but everybody was like, really want to do this? And especially after the second one, they were like, oh, we tap out. The Japanese tapped out. But because they declared war on the Japanese, they, on August 10th, moved in to occupy the northern part of the Korean Peninsula. And they determined that they were going to do occupying zones, like they did with Germany.
Okay.
Why in Korea? Doesn't really make sense to me, but it's what they decided. So in Washington, the U.S. colonels, Dean Rusk and Charles H. Bonsteel III, great name, were in charge of dividing the peninsula into the occupation zones between the Soviets and the U.S. on the 38th parallel. Why 38th parallel, are you wondering?
I am. Tell me.
Because it's if you look at it, it's like so random to pick this, but Husk said, quote, even though it was further north than could be realistically reached by U.S. forces, in the event of a Soviet disagreement, we felt it was important to include the capital of Korea in the area of responsibility of American troops.
Huh. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Continuing, faced with the scarcity of U.S. forces immediately available and the time and space factors, it would make it difficult to reach very far north before the Soviet troops could enter that area, end quote. So it's basically, we'll put it further north to give us a buffer zone, but we also get like Seoul.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I guess that's, it makes a little more sense.
But it's very much a, this looks good kind of response.
Right.
And this would be incorporated into the Japanese surrender on August 15th. So really the Russians battled the Japanese technically for like 6 days.
Okay. Okay, well, that's quick.
Yeah. Stalin actually agrees to halt at the 38th parallel to have the meeting and determine that if this is what they wanted. And on September 8th, 1945, the U.S. Lieutenant General John R. Hodge arrived in Incheon. Again, I don't speak Korean. I should have mentioned this. I don't speak any Korean. I don't speak any Eastern Asian languages.
I think you're doing great. I think you're, I mean, I'm terrible with names. So I think you're doing a great job so far.
I'm going to do my best. Some of these I have heard before, but we all know how I go with Asian languages. I just sound confident enough. We have the Soviets and now the U.S. forces in Incheon to accept the Japanese surrender just south of the 30th parallel. So Hodge actually becomes the U.S. head in Korea. And he goes about trying to, like, stupidly first, he tries to restore the colonial powers that were there. So the Japanese colonial administrators and the Koreans were like, no, thank you. So he was like, never mind. I'm gonna back off there. He, you know, did keep the Koreans who were in the government before in government power, because, you know, it's not good to start fresh with a whole new crop of people running a government. It doesn't tend to work well if you have no government experience.
No. What? Where are you getting this information from?
Numerous historical and modern accounts. So there are rebellions that pop up and, you know, on top of it, the U.S. refuses to recognize the provisional government of what would be the People's Republic of Korea due to suspected communist sympathies. And as anyone who studies the Cold War knows, this is really the first kind of war, proxy war that pops up because of the Cold War. I mean, besides the underlying issues that were happening before, because, you know, coming out of colonialism takes a lot of effort, as we've seen with numerous countries that have come out of colonialism.
Oh boy, yeah.
So we then have, in December 1945, a joint U.S.-Soviet Union commission at the Moscow conference, basically saying, okay, we're going to jointly, it was kind of like the same thing they planned to do with like Berlin and Germany a little bit too. We're going to jointly govern you for about 5 years. And then after 5 years, we'll have you become independent. Which
sounds easy enough.
To me, it feels very Treaty of Versailles.
Oh, yeah.
After World War One, and you're just like, oh, that didn't work well.
Like, why should we try this again? Did it work well the first time? Not so much.
They probably are like, it's different people. It'll be fine.
Yeah. Oh, God. Story of America's life.
We're like, but it's a different area. It'll try work here. It's like, we've tried this 6 times. So Koreans said no, and riots broke out. So the U.S. decided to ban strikes and outlaw the People's Republic of Korea government and their committees. So they're basically shutting this shit down.
Yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't work because there's larger scale civilian unrest, and they declared martial law, the U.S. did, because remember, the U.S. Army's there. And, you know, they were like, okay, this joint council's not working. Like, I'm assuming all the politicians and generals are in a room sitting there and like, it's not working. Let's just hold elections because that solves everything, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We've learned that one multiple times too.
Yeah. However, the Soviet authorities and the Korean communists were like, no, it would not be fair. And on top of it, many of those South Korean politicians actually boycotted as well. So it is not popular. But the U.S. probably said, fuck it. What harm could it do?
Because that's what we do best in America.
We are that kid who does the project the night before, doesn't practice this. I'll wing it.
Yep. 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 Mm-hmm. Yep. We all know that kid. Some of us have been that kid.
Everybody's been that kid at least once, and it does not work out well. So they hold elections in the southern half of Korea, so the U.S. half, on May 10th, 1948. They then hold parliamentary elections 3 months later in August. So it's kind of worked. They get a national political constitution on the 17th of July as well. And the general election had Syngman Rhee as the president in July 20th, 1948. So they do elect a president. They kind of get a political constitution going. But you know how people didn't like it? The it was determined, or a lot of people believe, that the Rhee regime really manipulated it to get into the power. But this is where the Republic of Korea, which was now is South Korea, this is how it was established in August 1948. So we see the founding was super solid, real solid. And so in the Soviet zone, they're like, huh, yeah, we're gonna take this communist rebel Kim Il-sung and put him into power and as a communist government,
right?
So that's how we get North Korea.
It's so funny how it sounds like two people like playing chess, and like they're just using this poor country as like the pawns in this game. You know, like you've got America on one side, you've got Russia on the other, and then Korea's caught and divided between the two.
Welcome to the Cold War.
Yep, there it is. There it is. God, it's so crazy how it just, I mean, when you really simplify it all, you're like, oh, so we're just playing a little game of Battleship here, aren't we?
We're playing a game of Battleship with real people's lives and not caring about the consequences.
Yeah. Oh, God, makes me so angry. This is why I could never do anything in politics.
And this would be like kind of where we see the idea of containment theory starting to form around this time, which containment theory was the U.S. idea. I believe the Dulles brothers, those assholes, developed it to basically contain the Soviet Union through friendly countries surrounding it, you know?
Right.
Because that's not going to cause problems.
No, of course not.
And that also like is similar to domino theory, which is going to drag like the U.S. back into Korea, whereas if one of these countries falls to become communist, then more countries will become communists, and more countries, you know, we all have seen dominoes when you stack them up and you hit them down. That's the theory, but with countries.
Right.
Strangely, I think personally, the Soviet Union withdraws their troops in 1948 and the U.S. withdraws in 1949. I mean, it makes sense because if you think, like, the Soviet Union had been involved in a war since the late 30s. They're tired. They got shit to rebuild. Stalin's purging people. It's a process. The U.S., they're right over in Japan, so it's not as far, you know. They're trying to rebuild Japan / shape Japan. And oh yeah, remember I mentioned the Chinese? Let's talk about them again.
They're back.
They're back. They never left. So, you know, we have the Chinese Civil War going on between the communists and the nationalists. And we have the Korean, North Korean government, which will help really fighting in Manchuria, which is close to Korea. And so we see him going back and forth. So in case you were wondering how long the Chinese Civil War was, it went on from April 1927 to May 1950. So they've been fighting for a minute.
And that's just in your own country. That is a civil war. Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, millions and millions of people died. So because the Korean communists helped them out and they're reaching the end, like basically at this point, Mao is clearly the winner of this. It's China's clearly going to be communist, and the nationalists flee to, I believe, Taiwan, which is why that's a whole issue, but I digress. So as China's trying to rebuild and like cement themselves in power, they promised and donated to North Korea 2,000 railway cars worth of supplies, and, you know, in returning like thousands of Koreans who fought for the Communist Party. They, on top of it, North Korea allowed for the Chinese communists in Manchuria, like, a place to put non-combatants and communicate with the rest of China. So it's like they exchange. This is why you won't see often that China says a lot about North Korea, because they're kind of buddy. They have a taut relationship, but it's like they, at their foundings, they were both pretty close. And so we know that the Communist Party in China sent back like weapons and their veterans. And basically, so you have between 50 to 70,000 Korean veterans who fought in the Civil War coming back to North Korea.
Damn.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And they would also, I think they also did financial support and other things. But yeah, so that's basically the buildup to this war. It's a geopolitical complex clusterfuck.
Oh, God. And there was already so much happening, like just throwing this on top of it is like, oh, God, it's from one war to another.
Yeah. And so they had been colonized for years. So, and they're trying to create their own country. They've been divided by an arbitrary line. And, you know, so if you were in some of these villages, it wasn't really a choice. The line was drawn and you lived there. So this is where you live now.
Jeez.
So we have the real key leaders are Kim Il-sung, who is Kim Jong-un's grandfather, who was very successful as a guerrilla leader. He got some training in Russia. He had actually been made a major in the Soviet army. And, you know, you have the ultra-nationalists, which is really centered around Syngman Rhee, who was educated in the U.S. and, you know, helped run the dissident Korean provisional government in exile. Kim Il-sung goes up to Stalin, you know, wanders up to his buddy Stalin.
You know, as you do, just like, let's strike up a conversation.
With someone who's very, very paranoid, yeah. Stalin was paranoid as fuck. That's what people don't always remember. So Kim pushes for an invasion of the South. Stalin's like, okay, let's hold off. You guys aren't ready. You're like, your forces aren't ready. And if the U.S. comes in, it's not going to be good. Because the Soviet army is still rebuilding.
Right.
There's a lot of people in gulags at this point. Because in case you didn't know or needed a reminder, the Soviet POWs, like, that were in other countries, like on the other, like, German camps and stuff, they all went to Siberia because automatically they were thought to be traitors to the state.
Mm. What a great place to, like, spend the rest of your days, Siberia.
The Soviet Union lost the most people in World War II, like civilians, like actual army, navy, and all that stuff. They had the highest casualty rate. I mean, part of it was that they did throw, like, people at the problem. It's not the best way to keep your casualty counts down. So Kim took this as a, oh, okay, let's go and rebuild this army. It's going to be known as the KPA. That's going to be the North Korean army. So he's like, okay, let's get this into a great fighting force modeled after the Soviet's army. Cue in Mulan's I'll make a man out of you montage.
Perfect.
but in the 20th century. So the Chinese are, you know, get, and at the same time, they're getting more and more veterans back from the Chinese. The Soviets are providing arms as well. So by 1950, the North Koreans had a ton of, like, the army was so much better. They have better equipment. They're better trained. They're doing better militarily wise than the South. So Kim Il-sung goes up to Moscow in March and April of 1950. Him and Stalin, I'm guessing they're in a room where it's like the circle table and there's a map and they're like pushing things around, planning out the invasion.
Okay, okay.
I don't know. That might just be like early modern medieval way, Renaissance way that people planned wars. I just assume that's how it is. Like when you push, you know, you push them around the map, you got the little thing. So June 25th, 1950, the North Koreans go across the 38th parallel, just lighting it up with artillery fire. And they, like, the main force was 53,000 men. It's their corps. It's not corpse.
It's spelled that way, though.
It is. So the North Korean I Corps drives across the Imjin River towards Seoul. So I guess they were just one. It's just one corps.
Okay.
So Corps 2, which is around 54,000 soldiers, then goes and attacks along the wider axis going through cities. So they're basically just spreading out in a semicircle, hitting cities Cheonghon, Inji, Hongcheon, and just going all the way down the east coast towards Kaesong. They enter Seoul on June 28th. So like 3 days later, they're like, sup, bitches?
We here.
But they did not get a quick surrender of the government or disintegration of the South Korean army, which was the goal. They were like, basically, we're going to show this big force of power. Y'all going to be like, okay, we give up.
Mm.
Which is not it wasn't a bad plan, but tell you the truth.
Yeah, but like and they couldn't have prepared for, I guess, you know, an alternative.
Oh, yeah. I guess you could, but the confidence, you know.
Yeah, you got to admire that big dick energy right there.
I was to say average white man energy, but yes.
Same thing, you know.
Yeah. So the remnants of Roka, which is the South Korean forces, decided to form a defensive line along the Han River. And so they did the river and then the East Coast Road to basically stop the North Koreans from advancing further south. So immediately they were like, hey, big brother US, we need like help, please.
Can you like come over and, you know, lend a helping hand, please?
Linda help, yeah. They contact good old Truman. I'm sure it was much more like, hey, assholes, you did this. Come help. That's what I would do. But this is why I cannot be in the army. My mouth is too sassy. So Truman was like, hey, MacArthur, get munitions over there. Use air cover to get U.S. citizens out, which I was like, I appreciate, but you also created this situation. So you should, like, if you're going to help, help.
Right.
Because they would just, I mean, they're all, you have to think also, there's a lot of U.S. Navy and military over in Japan.
Right.
Which is pretty close.
Right.
Truman was like, kind of smart. He did not want to, this is actually kind of smart. He did not want a declaration of war. So you have to, for the U.S., you have to go before Congress to declare war. Ask them to declare war. There's a vote. So, and that takes a lot of convincing.
Oh, yeah.
Because.
Yeah, I did. I do remember this. I do remember reading about this, that it was never technically war. It was, oh, God, what did they call it? Police action.
Yeah, that's what we've been doing. World War II is technically the last war we have been in.
God, that's so nuts. What? Vietnam War didn't qualify?
They did not declare a war as a police action.
Oh, my God.
Everything since has been like a police action. Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, Congress has not declared war since World War II. So it's also because there's a lot more strings attached when you declare war. A lot more things have to go through Congress. As we all know, those bitches take some time.
Mm-hmm.
So instead, Truman goes to the UN for a sanction against North Korea and the Soviets. The UN called for the invasion to halt on the 25th and then was like, hey, UN members, you have to go assist South Korea. On the 27th. Remember, the North Koreans make it into Seoul on the 28th, so they're clearly, like, deuces.
Mm.
don't give a fuck. And this, a lot of stuff that would be happening has to take place in the UN, has to take place in the Security Council, which the Soviet Union's on, the US, the British, The French. I'm missing one. There are several seats that are permanent. Like, there's five permanent ones.
French, British.
Russia, so the Soviet Union, UK, yeah, and the US. And then China.
Oh.
The issue was China or Taiwan going to be on the Security Council? Because the nationalists are in Taiwan. So this it's a big
what a shit show. Like, I mean, it's just, it's nuts.
It's literally a shit show. And then there's some rotating members. So other countries are on there. But the big ones are the five permanent members. Yeah, because the whole issue over admitting communist China to the UN is the whole deal right now. So the Soviet Union's boycotting. So it does allow actually the US to push more through because of it.
Okay.
But it's just, it adds to the shit showy nature of this, you know? And the US public, Congress is like, no, go support South Korea. The administration actually had to realize, okay, we don't have a good enough military power to go meet this invasion. We do have one of our top generals, General MacArthur, there. So he sent three divisions from Japan. But if you put ground forces, they're like, okay, if we get defeated now, we actually have men on the ground. So that's a lot of problems. We have around 8 weeks near Osan, the Kumu River, through Taeyong, south to Taeyu, where there's U.S. soldiers, some being killed, some fleeing.
It's, right.
You know, we're still struggling with the offset of World War II because we don't have enough weapons. There's, like, not enough troops. The amount of troops they sent for it, the Koreans, North Koreans, were more prepared. And, like, the wavering nature of, like, leadership, plus you have the threat of refugees coming through. So you have refugees coming when you're trying to fight a war. So the refugees are fleeing south.
Sure.
And then this is where, like, a big tactic was guerrilla warfare on top of it.
Mm.
So are the refugees refugees? Are they not refugees? Are they combatants? It starts to bring up these questions. So this kind of culminates into attacks on Korean civilians. We see this hundreds of refugees at a railroad viaduct near Nongri. It's west of the Nantong River during the last week of July. So there was, it was basically a massacre there because there was confusion. So it's this war is less clear, I think, than like World War I, World War II is like a lot clearer on what's happening, who's combatants, who's not.
Yeah.
And a lot of these people had just fought a total war. So your mindset's very much still there.
Right. Right. Well, and it's so easy, you know, when it's such a like black and white sort of thing. Like it's these people versus these people. It's North versus South. But no, there's so many different players in this.
Yeah. Finally, in the first weeks of August, we finally get the United Nations Command, which will be known as like UNC. We see the slowing of North Koreans as MacArthur kind of redesignates and they start to figure out what they're going to have to do. This started in June. It's August.
Good Lord.
Right? So we have a starting of the on the southern side successes with the 8th Army led by Lieutenant General Walton H. Walker and ROKA, which is the South Korean Army led by Major General Chung Il-wook-wook-on. They basically start rallying and getting more successes, starting to lead a charge, leading them back north. So they, one of the key ports kind of coming in for the 8th Army is Busan. And, you know, it's closer to the, like, Japanese. There's tons of people coming in. So they really need to protect this port. And this is one of the, like, bigger areas that they're trying to protect. So, especially because that's where the U.S. is getting their supplies from Japan.
Right.
And coming across the Pacific.
Right.
So there, Walker brings in Sherman and Pershing medium tanks, rocket launchers, artillery pieces, anti-aircraft guns, and close air support aircraft. So this is really where I know.
That's never a good sign.
Nope. So with the UN now in like kind of coalition now in control, they continue in September. Like they're getting an order of advance against the Nantong River, like Taegu line. It's the Busan perimeter. So they're building a perimeter around so they can keep this open and keep getting supplies.
Mm, okay.
And this is where a lot of coastal anchors, it'll keep expanding. We have the Battle of Tabudong in August, mid-August of that year, where the South Korean 1st Division and the U.S. 27th Regiment the combat team actually defeat the North Koreans' main armored thrust towards Daegu, towards that perimeter line. And so we see basically they're starting to get pushed back. In September, the North Korean had two of its cores reduced to 60,000 men, its tanks destroyed, and pushed well away from that border line. So it seems like, okay, we're getting some movement, we're getting some traction after the North Koreans basically swept down the peninsula almost completely.
Yeah.
The shift in this war is by the appearance of the X Corps and Incheon, at Incheon. So MacArthur, famous World War II general.
Right.
Like, led, I believe, at both fronts. And he was like, you know what? I need an amphibious. I haven't seen it spelled in so long. It's like, oh, God. Amphibious landing deep behind enemy lines. So think of along the lines of like a D-Day kind of scenario where you're going to start cutting them off and getting further in. And he actually started planning as early as July.
Okay.
So
now we're in September?
Yeah.
Okay.
He worked with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They determined that the 1st Marine Division and the 8th Army Remaining Infantry Division, the 7th, would go on this. It includes some South Korean Marine and Infantry units and another backloading of U.S. support troops. It was called X Corps, which, badass name.
I know. That is cool. It kind of sounds like a gas company, too. Like, oh, where'd you get gas? At X Corps.
Or like a Marvel company.
Yes, I can see that, too.
It's like, it seems like a comic book thing. And this would be led by Major General Edward M. Almond, MacArthur's chief of staff. Did not plan that. Enjoyed it. We got double almonds
in our episode. That's nuts.
So at this point, because they're going so far behind the line, the resistance is so thin just because they don't have the manpower, but they are stubborn as fuck.
Mm.
So, you know, we have the X Corps entering Seoul on September 25th. So they managed to retake Seoul, the capital. Then the bulk of the 7th Division advance onto Suwon and reaches the 8th Army on the 6th. So you see them kind of slowly congealing and becoming one massive army, retaking their southern half of the peninsula.
Okay.
And on the 26th, MacArthur and Syngman Rhee actually go into the capital building in Seoul and declare the South Korea's liberated. It's great. Mm. Everything's done.
All done. We can go now.
Yeah, definitely not done. They keep pushing the North Koreans back up north, but they're taking thousands of South Koreans hostage and as slave laborers, or they executed thousands of people, such as at Sejong, where they massacred 5,000 civilians.
Yikes.
So on top of that, the South Korean army and national police aren't actually doing much better, because any suspected communists they find or even think about it, similar things happen. It's not great.
God.
And the U.S., you know, the U.S. is bombing. It's a clusterfuck. It's been determined that the last 2 weeks of September saw atrocities like those in Europe during the 30 Years War of the 17th century, which is so bad. It's revenge. It's just vicious for vicious sake. It's killing civilians, destroying things.
That's not ruthless. Great. Yeah, ruthless. And you're talking about, I mean, I'm assuming like thousands of deaths, like hundreds of thousands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, easily.
Yeesh.
Wiping villages off the maps that have been there for like centuries, millennia. So MacArthur is like, you know what? Fuck you. Let's go into North Korea. So they actually go across the 30th parallel, go deep into North Korea. So they just keep following them. They actually get close to the Manchurian border, so the border with China.
Mm.
And China was like, we will defend ourselves. Back the fuck off.
Yeah, we don't want to have to get in on this.
Yeah. I'm assuming they use political language, but basically it was like, back the fuck off. So mid-October, and still, like, this is 1950, like, this is a 3-year-long war. We're in year one. So mid-October, Truman meets MacArthur on Wake Island, and he's like, MacArthur's like, it'll be done by Christmas. Never say this shit.
No.
Because that's what they said about World War One, and guess what? It was not.
Yeah, it's terrible to put like a timeline on anything. And when you put it on like a war, You're just asking for problems.
Yeah. Have we not learned from the Soviet Union's five-year plan? Does not happen in 5 years. So in November, the Chinese was like, so as soon as they like had determined that like the timeline to end the war was like Christmas, so basically end of year, November that year, the Chinese opened up their armies to the North Koreans. And the UN forces were like, what? So they spent their new year defending the line to the south of Seoul. So they got pushed all the way back.
Okay.
Yeah, so we have the push of the North Korean south, the U.S. South Korean UN forces pushing them almost to China, and then them getting pushed all the way back down, like half.
Oh, God. Push pull.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we have, like, I mean, imagine how defeating that is. Like, you were almost done, and then this shit happened.
Yeah.
So the new field commander, General Ridgway, picked up his, took over, and they begin their slow advance north in the spring of 1951. We have them back at the allies, the UN, South Korean allies, back at the 38th parallel, and then the Chinese launched another offensive.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So we have a British 19th Brigade almost completely taken out at the Imogen River. The 27th Commonwealth Brigade fighting as well, but they held the line somehow.
Impressive.
But they realized, you're like, hey, we probably shouldn't go north of this line again because it didn't go well.
Yeah, like things keep happening when we try and approach it.
Yeah, so they just basically sit at the 38th parallel. And for the next 2 years, just fighting along the border of it.
Oh, God. See, this is what annoys me. And we kind of talked about this before we started recording, but this is what annoys me about war in general is like not so much of war is like not a battle. Like, I mean, I picture like battle in the battlefields and we're shooting and fighting and killing. Like, no, it's a lot of sitting and waiting. Like, I just finished reading a book where it was all about it's super cool, but it was about women in World War II who were Clubmobile girls, and they basically would drive like this bus around to like give out coffee and donuts and cigarettes and stuff to American soldiers like at their camps, and just to like boost morale. But it was all about the main girl trying to figure out if her fiance had survived. And you find out in the end that he had been a prisoner of war for months and basically died on the walk back to camp because he got an infection. And it's stuff like this where it's like, I'm hearing about it, I'm just like, there are so many people that are dying probably just from waiting around and getting like infections and like frostbite. And I mean, it's, oh God, it's insane.
That's what I think the show MASH really shows well, yeah, is how much of it is a waiting game, mm-hmm, and how much like you're so mad that you're stuck there.
I love MASH. Oh, I loved MASH.
Fun fact, the TV show MASH was on air longer than the Korean War happened. No.
Yeah, it was on a long time. So
it was on a long time.
That's impressive. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So this is where we get these heavily fortified positions. You know, you got artillery, mines, wire. Everybody has that good image of the trench warfare of the first and second, well, really the First World War. Kind of think of like how they built, like basically built up along this line. Both sides really had to focus on air power because think about it, you're not really moving very far.
Right.
So if you can drop bombs behind enemy lines, that'll help. And this is where the U.S. really succeeds. We're very good in the air.
Yep.
Our heavy bombers would take out cities and industrial plants in North Korea and attack the transport system so basically the Chinese fighting on the side of the North Koreans used pack horses as the way to transport their shit.
God. Okay, what's next? Carrier pigeons?
Probably be safe. Mm. But think about it. Like, how are you going to tell? You can walk in different paths. You don't need roads for pack horses as much.
Yeah.
So you can go under tree cover more. This is really, we see the American B-52 bomber and like their lighter planes around them starting to get challenged by the Russians MiG F-15 fighters, which were flown by the Chinese, and they actually started defeating the Americans in the air.
Oh.
Until, yeah, Americans introduced the F-86 Sabre tip balance, and it was basically, it becomes the first supersonic air combat fighting, and America regained its supremacy, which is really interesting. See, that's the interesting part of war that I like, is like the technological advances. It's horrible the damage they cause now, but like the innovation is really interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing what they've done.
Mm-hmm. And then in the Navy, the Russian Navy got pretty much taken out several times. Because for a brief Russian history, we had the Russo-Japanese War, where the Japanese humiliated the Russians. World War One, a Russian Civil War, which led to the Soviet Union. Then World War Two.
It's a lot. So, it's a lot.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot. So they are working on their navy, but the U.S. is basically taking out. And even the North Koreans' torpedo boats were no match for it. The U.N. group firepower were like, bye-bye. Mm. So North Korea had a tight blockade around it. So they couldn't get any, basically all supplies had to come in through its China connection.
Right. Okay.
Because in mid-1951, they're not moving anywhere. Nothing's happening.
Mm.
They decide to go and talk it out. So they go and begin armistice talk. It takes over 2 years. Like, it doesn't go well.
Oh, see, again, we're back to this waiting. We're back to the waiting. Mm-hmm.
So imagine you're stuck, especially like the UN soldiers, you're stuck there. Especially, I'm thinking like, so the US and the Soviets agreed to this. So say you're British, you're from Canada, you're from Australia, like elsewhere. You're stuck here and your country, like, really just decided to follow UN action, and your country didn't even make this decision, like, to divide this country.
I know. It's, again, it's hard because, like, I'm thinking about, like, what we know about, like, Korea and, like, mm-hmm. the Korean government now. So, like, it kind of clouds your perspective. But, God, I mean, I feel so bad for, like, the people, like, at this time.
Oh, yeah. So the real sticking point is the tens of thousands of communist prisoners held in camps on Koje Island off the coast of South Korea. You know, this is going to come up repeatedly. Keeping people in camps isn't a great idea. Doesn't work well. But I mean, I get it. They're like, okay, we need them back. Like,
yeah.
Really big sticking point is over these POWs. This would also lead to thousands of POWs unwilling to be repatriated. So unwilling to go back to their country of origin. So maybe they're now disillusioned or whatnot. They don't want to.
Mm. Okay.
So there were actually a bunch of mutinies in the Koje camps before they figured out a way to basically repatriate those that wanted to go, get asylum for the others. So
okay,
it's not going well. Then on July 1953, basically when they had a ceasefire, and it's called Operation Big Switch, where they swapped POWs. I just love that it's called Operation Big Switch. I was like, obviously, that's what it is.
Like, that's the best name we could come up with.
You know, someone's in there and they're like trying to think of a cool name. It's like, just fucking call it Operation Big Switch.
I know. Like, who's the copywriter on this? Like, you know what? Here's what we're going to do. We're going to call it exactly what it is. No beating around the bush. We're going to call it the Big Switch, because that's what's going to go down right now.
It's going to be a big switch. During the negotiations that led to this, it would be the revised Geneva Convention of 1949, which required, quote, any detaining authority, end quote, that held POWs, return them to their homelands as rapidly as possible when a war ended. It's basically like, hey, war's done. Return the people. It's done.
Like, do we need to say this? Like, I feel like it should just already be happening, but okay.
Yeah, sadly, no. This all for all policy really could force some people, like I mentioned earlier with the Soviet Union, some of them did not want to go back because they knew what they were facing. They basically knew they were going back to a death sentence. So they didn't want to go back, but they, like, you have to do it.
Mm. Yeah, nobody wants to get sent to Siberia.
No. I think they called them death trains too. The ones that took them.
God. bad. Like, I mean, that's, you're just setting yourself up for failure.
Yeah, I think that's, it might have been the unofficial, if I remember from what my friends who studied that period said. This is really, the early reports of, like, atrocities happening to POWs on both sides, really heavily on the North Korean sides, leads to these issues. The South Korean government really was opposed to complete and involuntary repatriation, because some of these detainees were actually South Koreans who had been forced to fight with the North Koreans. So they were forced into it. So they're like, we can't send our citizens there because they're clearly going to be murdered.
Right.
The North Koreans were like, who had much, like, who were responsible, like, oh, yeah. Oh. So there's a lot of people being like, what should we do? The Chinese, however.
Oh, they're back. That They're part of this again.
Oh, they've been here the whole time. They've been fighting. That's where most of the supplies are coming through China. You know, they're hanging out. So their leaders knew some people would refuse repatriation because they were impressed. So they basically were soldiers from the Nationalist Army that they forced into this war. Because, yeah, that shit happens. Think of, like, a draft. Impressment is like a draft, but someone shows up and says, well, you're doing this now. The most common way people think of it is part of the reason the U.S. fought wars with Britain was because the British would impress American soldiers onto their ships. British man of war would come up to an American, like, merchant vessel and be like, well, we need sailors. You're a member of this. And then just take their sailors.
Yeah, you know how that works.
which is what the Chinese did, the communists did with the Nationalist Army. So they were like, we're not going to make it mandatory because they're just going to cause more problems. Because think about, they're veterans, they fought, their experience with this and whatnot.
Right.
So everybody's like, okay, we'll do a POW name exchange and numbers and the categories. So let's get to the tallies. Be prepared for the it's going to get worse section. So the U.S. Armed Forces had 11,500 men missing in action. Communists only have 3,198 Americans in custody, as well as 1,219 other United Nations POWs, mostly British and Turkish. That's a big difference.
Well, and that's just missing, right? That's just missing. I mean, that's not even counting deaths. Like, that's even scarier to me, honestly, when people go missing like that.
Yeah. So South Koreans, an estimated 88,000 missing in action.
Wow. Wow.
And they only got 7,142 names that were in the camps.
Whew. Yikes. Okay.
I think the question is, I don't know if they exchanged those that had been there that were either murdered or died from, you know, torture, execution, starvation, mistreatment, infection, like all of that. So the Allies were like, oh shit, this is, the treatment was way worse than we thought. Probably most of the missing in action had died in fighting. You know, they think about 15,000 died in communist hands, which would, they figure out all but 2,000 South Koreans had died by, like, the torture, the execution, the starvation, and all the problems that would come up with it. But still, that'd be fucked up.
Yeah. Oh, no, for sure. For sure. I'm still reeling over the fact that you said it was 88,000? Like,
it's gonna get worse.
And they only found, like, 7,000 names? Like, I mean, that's...
That were there at that time. That's what I think it is. I don't think it's total list. I think that's just who was there. So,
God, I mean, but still, just thinking about that, I'm like, okay, where's the other 81,000?
Mm-hmm. So we have estimated numbers of the POWs in the UN committee custody. So early on, it was like too low or too high. So they were like 90,000 or 170,000. Official lists now have determined it was 95,531 North Koreans, 20,700 Chinese, and 16,243 South Koreans, for a total of 132,474.
Oof. Yeah, that's of people, especially, like, all of those people, to me too, this is not even their battle that they were fighting. Like, I mean, I know it's called the Korean War, even though it's not a war, but also, like, that many people died for something that wasn't even their cause.
Yeah, it's crazy because, like, that's, and I mean, that's their, like, the U the United Nations list of POWs. So apparently around 40,000 of the missing men were South Korean who had already passed loyalty investigations and would not be considered to go to North Korea. Truman ruled in January 1952 that no POW in UN custody would be forced to return to North Korea or China against their will, which is actually, I think, fair.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's, it's a good idea. Like, I understand where that's coming from. And that's, it is fair for sure. I could see where that would also create other issues. I mean, I don't know if they would be bigger issues than sending them back to a country that's just going to murder them for coming back.
Or, you know, re-educate
them. Right. Yes, let's not.
I always love that phrase.
Let's not say murder. Let's say reprogram. That's my favorite.
So those that chose to return north would continue on a one-for-one basis until they got all 12,000 ally POWs returned.
Okay.
Which, again, fair.
Yeah.
Very, very pragmatic.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, this process required extensive screening of individuals about their preference and basically created a shit ton of problems in the camps.
Well, naturally.
This is really like kind of a hidden thing. People don't realize like POWs revolting were another aspect of the war happening behind the lines. So not only are you manning the 38th parallel, you also have to deal with the POWs fighting and trying to revolt and all that. And on top of it, you have guerrilla warfare of those in the southern provinces attacking. We see the most effective in 1951 with Van Fleek, U.S. General, ordered Major General Pak Sun-yup, one of South Korea's most effective officers, to break up the guerrilla activity. They go through from December 1951 to March 1952. They killed 11,000 partisan and sympathizers, captured 9,916 more, which is really suggesting a scorched earth policy, which was not what I believe he was asked to do. But yeah,
boy, this, oh boy,
you know, this surpasses the previous war atrocity by the UN the execution of 800 to 1,000 villagers at Kongzhen in February 1951. So Nelson did great. Both of us, we're real bad.
Yeah, yeah. Not doesn't paint, I feel like a lot of these things don't paint us in an excellent light.
No, it doesn't. So we see the demilitarized zone, or DMZ, which is still there, established on the border. Everybody kind of backs up a little bit, and the UN determines to set up a commission to supervise the armistice. We had around 100,000 British servicemen, the Brits, in the war, and on top of, you know, in July 1951, a Canadian brigade, some more the British, the Australians, the New Zealands, the Indians, which is the Commonwealth Division as well. So it's not just, that's what I think is interesting, it's not just the U.S. in there, because it's a U.N., it's kind of like the first U.N. action. There are a lot more people involved than you thought.
Right.
So, let's end this war, quote unquote.
Do we?
Technically, no.
Yeah.
It's neither here nor there. So, from September to November 1952, the Chinese are still trying to push the Allies back to the 38th parallel. And as they're raging through, you know, we keep having these short fires, like all these things. And, you know, as everybody's losing men, we have the 8th Army in just mid-November lose 10,000 men. The Chinese lost 15,000 men. And the Chinese actually go to President-elect Eisenhower. And, you know, they're like, hoping they can convince him not to go on a major offensive in the 53. Eisenhower and Secretary of State Dulles, yes, the one that Dulles Airport is named after, him and his brother.
Oh my God.
Yes. The Dulles brothers, as one of my international studies professors says, she believes that they're still, they have their heads and they're still spewing out policy in the basement of the Pentagon. They basically, if you guys are Patreon members and you've heard the Guatemala episodes, you'll know the Dulles brothers basically led U.S. foreign policy from, I think, like the 40s on until they died. And, you know, one was the head of the CIA, one was the Secretary of State a lot, or in the State Department a lot. They, you know, the Dulles brother, who was in the CIA, actually led the commission on JFK's assassination. He did not like JFK. JFK did not like him. Take with that what you will. but if you read up on the Dulles brothers, they're fascinating, the amount of shit they're in.
It sounds like it. It sounds like they're like those guys that like have their hands in everything.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And they're like not even hiding the fact that they're smoking their cigars and twirling their mustaches. Dulles and Eisenhower were like, yeah, this, we got to get out of this war. It's not good for our national security. And, you know, they realize, okay, China is going to be this big power in Asia, and Korea is only one aspect of this, that if we can get out of it, it'll be great, especially because, you know, the public is not a fan.
Not so much.
No, it's a lot of taxes. It's a lot of losing, like, the draft is involved in this. I mean, I had family members that fought in Korea. You know?
Yeah, I did too. I did too.
So it's not popular. Dulles goes for negotiations. He's like, okay, voluntary repatriation involves screening by an international agency, not just the U.S. South Korean teams, which I'm like, okay, fair.
Okay.
So they had the UN and international, and the International Committee of the Red Cross doing an exchange of sick and disabled POWs, kind of being like, okay, let's get this started. Eisenhower's like, yeah, let's go.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's basically this goodwill test. Did work, actually. On top of it, March 5th, 1953, Stalin died.
Oh, so that- well, there you go.
So Stalin died, and right after that, the Politburo voted that we got to end this Korean War. It's not worth it. Mao Zedong knew that, okay, we can't keep this going without the support of the Soviet Union. So, because, again, China is still recovering from a 20-plus year civil war.
Yeah.
You have to remember, the country's supporting, like, everybody supporting this is pretty much recovering from devastating wars.
It's insane. That's why it's so weird that it's like, it's like a bad breakup. Like, you just, like, jump right into something that's also toxic.
Yeah. The Chinese were like, okay, we'll take voluntary repatriation. So that's good. And they start, you know, doing, working on screening and all of that. They did agree to the exchange of sick and disabled POWs, which was good. However, Ri comes back, you know, the leader of South Korea. He's like, he kind of refused to publicly surrender his March North and unifying position. That was his, what he was going with.
Mm.
However, we have heard privately, like, they, it was shown privately that he hinted he might accept an armistice if there were serious commitments by the U.S., including this like an ambiguous mutual security alliance, kind of like, if they come back, you have to come back.
Okay.
And $1 billion in economic aid.
Oh, okay. We just had to toss that in at the end. Yeah, got it.
Yeah. Which, I mean, think about it. Both, like, the peninsula is decimated. Kind of makes sense.
Well, and
but I just love these.
$1 billion in, what is this, is 1952?
Yeah, 53.
Like, $1 billion at that time. I can't fathom $1 billion now. So that was so much money then.
So it's an 866% increase.
Oh my God. So you're talking like almost $9 billion?
Yeah.
Jeez.
$9.667 million.
Yikes.
Yeah. So just chump change, guys. It's fine.
Right.
You know, the Chinese were still thinking, hey, for us to get what we want, it is really to battle it out in territory. So they keep fighting. We then see the armistice, like, we had this initial, like, agreeing of the POWs and all that and the sticking points. Well, then they moved to a military armistice commission, which was 10 officers representing each of the belligerents, or basically the combatants, a neutral nations supervisory commission, which was Sweden, Switzerland, Poland, and Czechoslovakia. I mean, some of those I get, some of those I don't.
Yeah.
A neutral nations reparation commission, which was Sweden, Switzerland, Poland, Czechoslovakia, and India, who would be the custodian of the POWs.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I mean, they're so not involved. So, okay.
Yeah.
Like, it's the only thing I can think of. I'm like, I'm not sure how India came into the picture here, but, like, I guess because they're so removed from what's going on.
Well, I mean, they're in the Commonwealth, so
yeah, yeah,
they have troops there, but they're also, like, the closest country there, so they can, like, more likely supervise. So we have from August 5th to September 6th, around 75,823 communist soldiers and civilians returned to their regimes, which was really all but 5,640 of them. So, like, there's 5,640 of them that stayed.
Okay.
And then 7,862 South Korean soldiers, 3,597 U.S. soldiers, and 1,377 other nationality soldiers of other nationalities, including some civilians, returned to UN control. So they did their swap. And this, I mean, you know, it was so many things. You have the POW stripping off their, like, capitalist uniforms and, like, singing to march approved songs from the communist side. So I'm just like, oh my god. Those who refused repatriation, actually, the handling of it turned into somewhat of a clusterfuck, as, you know, agents among the communist POWs and interrogators, like, just were horrible to the Indians that were, like, supervising this. And, you know, really only around 628 Chinese and Koreans changed their minds and went north, 21,000 that had actually returned to UN control. So, like, it's interesting to see, like, what goes back and forth.
Right.
Most of those who didn't repatriate settle in North Korea or Taiwan.
Oh, okay.
And, yeah. Again, Taiwan comes up because it's technically China.
Yeah.
Yeah. For the armistice agreement, actually, the U.S. organized an international conference in Geneva for everybody to come up and talk about the political future of Korea. There was no agreement.
And there still isn't today.
There still isn't. Yeah. Basically, you have the battlement back and forth. They have, this is the one really cool thing I found on the Wikipedia article. I know I've talked your ear off about this, but it was hard to cut. This is cut down too.
Oh, I know. No, I mean, there's reasons why people write, like, you know, 700 page books about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me find where it is. It's just, okay. So there is actually set up to find remains still of those missing.
Oh.
So there are 416 Korean unknown soldiers buried at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific in Hawaii.
Okay.
We also have records that indicate that of the names transmitted between the list, only 858 of the 1,300 were correct. And we have an additional 4,167 containers of returned remains. They have identified 4,219 individuals. They also, of those, around, like, a little under 3,000 were identified from the U.S. They only could give identified 416 by name. And from 1996 to 2006, North Korea recovered 220 remains near the border.
Okay.
Near the Chinese-Korean border. So.
Man.
In case you're wondering what happened to some of those people, they still are finding remains from the war. They're still trying to return people to their homelands and to their families.
God.
But that is a brief history of the Korean War, and hopefully explains a little bit why it's so contentious. And like I said, if you're interested in it, definitely delve deeper. There's a ton of great sources. There's a ton of really, really good firsthand accounts, you know. So definitely delve deeper. But it's like an hour 30 recording, so.
And that, and that's the light version too of this war. Like, it's insane.
I always love that. This is the light version. Yeah. So what do you think? What did you think?
I mean, it's just another example of us Americans putting our noses in things that aren't our business. Like, I mean, it makes me wonder, like, if we would have the relationship we do with Korea now had things gone differently back then. But I mean, at the same time, it's like, I don't, you know, if we hadn't stepped in, you know, where would communism be? So, I mean, it's I don't know. It just brings up a lot of, like, what if questions. And I mean, it's easy for me to say, you know, having had nothing to do with it, like, wow, what a pointless venture. But I mean, I like to think that there are certain things that came out of it that were beneficial. But yeah, I don't know. It's war in general to me. I'm just like, most of the time, it just seems so pointless. Like, it's just, you know, it's fascinating, though. I mean, it really is. There's a lot that you had in there that I didn't know sort of like the origins of, I guess, that was like the main thing. And I think that on top of the fact that all the players in this were mostly coming out of other wars, like, I mean, just complicates things so, so immensely. This is definitely like one of the wars that I hear that I don't hear as much about. Like, I mean, I feel like you usually hear about World War One, World War Two, and in America, we hear about the Civil War. So,
and like Vietnam.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and I think we're at the point too where a lot of people that lived then are gone. So, it's, I can see where this is one that would kind of disappear into the history books. So, I found that really interesting.
It's fascinating just because it's kind of the first time, not the first time, well, yeah, it's kind of the first time with US supremacy in the global stage that you see the country doing this. Because you have the Spanish-American War, but I wouldn't say the U.S. was a major player. It was like we were on the up and up when we did it, but we're not in the American century yet like we will be after the Second World War. And you see definitely the U.S. learning from Britain and how to stick our nose in everybody's business.
Oh, God, we're so good at it. We're so good at it. It's, oh, God.
We learned from our father, aka the British Empire.
It's true. I was just watching a like pirated version of Hamilton on Broadway the other night. And I'm just like, damn, like King George up in here, like, shut up. But also us, too.
Oh, yeah. So, Kelly, do you want to tell everyone where to find your wonderful podcast that is definitely cheerier than this?
Oh, yes. And you know what? We definitely don't cover as many historical events on our podcast, although if you're lucky, we might review a historical romance or two. So my podcast is Boobies and Newbies. You can find us on boobiesandnewbies.com or on all your socials at Boobies Podcast. We're, you know, streaming on all the usual podcast platforms. So wherever you're listening to this podcast, go find us.
Yeah. And next week, I'll be back with another friend talking about other horrible things, probably.
Yay.
Okay, bye.
Hey, everybody. It's Kelly, host of Boobies and Newbies, part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Every episode, I invite a romance reading newbie to read and review their very first romance novel alongside me, a self-proclaimed romance novel addict. We're talking everything from bisexual pegging.
We need more pegging on TV. We need it in books. We need it in real life. We need to talk about it.
To the deepest intricacies of relationships.
It really is like we're fighting for us.
Yes.
Like we're, let's fight.
That's beautiful.
We cover it all. Find and follow us on social media at Boobies Podcast and catch up on previous episodes on your favorite podcast streaming platform.
Maine, the northernmost state in America, usually thought of as a quaint, safe vacation destination. Our motto is, the way life should be. But did you know serial killer John Joseph Joubert was raised in Maine and was convicted of 3 stabbing murders of young boys? Or the unsolved abduction of baby girl Ayla Reynolds, supposedly stolen from her bed near Christmas 2011. Her body has never been found. These are just 2 of the Maine stories Murderific has covered. We cover crimes from all areas and Maine cases as well. Murderific True Crime Podcast, hosted by me, Bernadette, can be found on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, or wherever you listen to podcasts, or go to murderific.com. We will be executing podcasts one crime at a time.
Of Domesticity, we're available on all podcatchers. Remember to rate, review, subscribe to help spread the word, or just force other people to listen to it. Our Facebook and Twitter are at Domestic Podcasts, and our Instagram is at The Cult of Domesticity. We also have podcast merch at Threadless.
As well, if you want to support us financially or show some appreciation, we have a PayPal tip jar and a Patreon, which has some pretty great perks. Any topic suggestions, feel free to email us at domesticpodcast@gmail.com. Remember to stay domestic and cult-free.